Welcome to the Brainstorm, episode 111. We got Frank with us today because, big surprise, we're talking AI. But even bigger surprise, we're talking why Google is trouncing the competition and why Nick is more confident than ever that OpenAI is having its legs swept out from underneath it. But Frank, maybe you just walk us through the Gemini 3 release and then we can get into the competitive dynamics.
I generally disagree with that take or the conviction with which it's being presented.
We hope you would.
Google released their latest version of Gemini. It feels like these are all the same now when there's a new model that comes out because, you know, people only release models if it's the best across numerous benchmarks. But yes, Gemini 3 on paper is the best AI model out there to date. I think some interesting things. One, the Google engineering team has said that, kind of in vague terms, that pre-scaling laws are continuing to work, which basically means this is something that when GPT-5 was released earlier this year, the market buzz was scaling laws are failing. We're having diminishing returns. Google is saying that's not true. They must have done a huge training run for Gemini 3. That's part of the reason why it is the best model across these different benchmarks. Reactions to the model, and they released it day one in Gemini and across different Google services. So it's also backing the AI mode. And it is a material step up. I mean, I've been using it side by side with ChatGPT with 5.1 thinking. On some tasks, Gemini is better. On some tasks, ChatGPT is better. It's relatively a toss-up, but Google's product has gotten really good. They've added personalization and memory to the Gemini product, which I also think is part of the reason why ChatGPT has been so engaging since they've added that, and a few other AI companies have added kind of cross-chat memory and personalization. So the models know more about you, and then the more they know, the more improved your experience is. And then outside of the whole language model space, Google released Nano Banana Pro. You didn't prompt me for this. I don't know if you planned on me talking about this now or later, but that almost is more impressive to me than Gemini 3, where it's able to comprehend information and present it, not just in like the most photorealistic picture ever, but also creating slides and these compressions of information into detailed diagrams in a way that I haven't seen any other model do in the past. And it feels like kind of a breakthrough moment on that side.
Right. You would have thought Copilot would have been able to figure out
why. Well, okay. I have a simple take on that, which is that like Microsoft's approach has been take this amazing new transformer architecture diffusion, like this new AI technology, and apply it to these tools that were built like 40 years ago. And I think that with such a new technology, the best way to convey information, which like all of Microsoft's productivity suite is a place to store and convey information, whether it's in a Word doc or a PowerPoint file. And I just think these tools that were created so long ago for humans to use a GUI for, like a keyboard, mouse, display, are just not the right tools for AI to build with. And what you're seeing with diffusion is kind of like cutting straight to, we just want to create a compelling representation of what the user wants and what can be conceived well, or received well on the other end. And that's really what Nano Banana Pro does.
All right, Frank.
I have a theory about kind of like the future state of AI architectures. And I think that as you couch it, Frank, or I agree with basically how you couch it, which is compared head-to-head on a text-based AI, it's actually, they are sufficiently advanced and still have sufficient weaknesses that it's very hard to tell. Like even the benchmarks, some of the benchmarks are dumb. They're like question and answers on questions that you would never get asked that you would never be able to answer. And so you, the average user, are like, well, yes, that indicates some raw level of capability, but does it really translate into anything useful? And so you really have to work with them to see. And these language models are all on transformer architectures where you're taking language and you're converting it into tokens and you're filling in the next token. And then the image generation models are all, at least at first, were all diffusion architectures where you take, basically you train something on an image getting noisier and noisier and noisier associated with the text. And then you undo the process where you start out with noise and make it less and less noisy and the image magically appears. And this new generation of kind of multimodal image generation architectures, which I think Nano Banana is best in class, is combining to some extent kind of transformer understanding, kind of the tokens and the ordered information that goes into something, and this kind of diffusion image generation, almost kind of like hallucinate the future type architecture. And to me, it seems obvious that the future state architecture for these systems, for very powerful systems, is even in the language space, is going to be a combination of diffusion and transformer. Just like we have left brain, right brain, the left brain is more kind of like the language, more transformer-like, right brain is more diffusion-like, and kind of future AI architectures are going to have a combination of the two. And then the thing that's missing that actually Google's published the best paper on that I've seen anyway is like a good in-state memory system that can do like kind of compression. And so for Google's, it's a Titans architecture. So I think the future, the ultimate, the true AGI will have a combination of transformer and diffusion and some kind of memory system. And what's interesting about Nano Banana is it's clearly, on the language side, it's like, yes, it's slightly better in some benchmarks. You know, who knows if it's useful. On the diffusion side, on the image generation side, it's clearly like much, much better than anything we've seen, not only in generating images, but that implies it can also process and understand the context of images better. And so then I think that's in terms of, you know, think about the user interface transition we went through in computers, where we went through, originally it was text interface, and then it became this graphical user interface. Well, maybe the actual future state of AI user interface is not just spoken text or written text, but it's something that is more kind of like dynamic and graphical. If so, then this is the kind of like foundation on which that kind of, so to speak, on which that kind of architecture might be built. And so there it really is, I think, an interesting breakthrough and is more kind of points towards the future a little more completely than the language first models.
Right. Other models could take an image and turn it into 1,000 words. It's the first one that can take 1,000 words and turn it into an image. That is useful, I would say.
That's more representative of those 1,000 words. Right. I mean, I think it's that other models also take an image and turn it into 1,000 words, but the 1,000 words are wrong. Like if you give a bar chart to another model and say, what are the values here? Like infill them, even if they're labeled, it'll often get them wrong. And so it's a pretty crude and elementary thing, as in processing PDFs is something we as knowledge workers do all the time. It's like I look at a chart and be like, oh, this is roughly where these numbers are. And clearly the language only, even the multimodal language models are very weak at that. I think this indicates that even if, I'm not sure that Gemini Pro can yet do that well, but it certainly seems like it's a step forward in that direction.
The real breakthrough is actually being able to take words and put it reliably on the image itself. I think that's really the unlock that is vastly different and more performative when you look at Nano Banana, even Nano Banana and then Nano Banana Pro. Like being able to take those 1,000 words, synthesize it, and then put, you know, maybe a few of them on the image itself is really where there's power in the model, because that is applicable to a wide ranging of, you know, different use cases beyond just generating fun images to send around to your friends. There's real business use case for being able to put words on image, like YouTube thumbnails, the whole gamut. We talked about it on Friday, but I think that's the real unlock for Nano Banana Pro.
Okay, last week, Brett, and we got a lot of comments in the comments section about this, your take was that part of the competitive moat of someone like OpenAI was the memory and context. Someone on Twitter suggested you trying to export it. Did you attempt that over the weekend? Have you tried it with Gemini 3? And then
no, I haven't, but I saw the comment and it was a good one. And basically it's, I had described, hey, if you stick kind of like a medical history, you have a long chat with a model, it's a pain to transfer that information over to somewhere else. And so then therefore there's stickiness to these models based on not just the long-term memory function, which is something where OpenAI is trying to take context across different conversations and intelligently embed it. Like it knows my kids' ages and, you know, what I do for work and kind of like some of my style choices around what I want. But also in the context of a specific chat that I go back to over and over again, how do you compress it and take it out? And I I assume it works reasonably well. I think a challenge that these models generally have is if you have a very long conversation going with one of these models, it begins to forget like key information that's up at the top of the conversation. And so OpenAI just introduced shared chats where like being able to like fork a chat and be like, this is actually the key context and I want it to kind of be retained and I want to build off of that in different directions, I think is important. And I think that there's a lot of kind of engineering art and design and figuring out how to take lots of raw information and compress it into one of these things. And then, you know, transmit it without losing something that's key to right. process.
Wait, Brett, what was the exact recommendation? Was it you to ask ChatGPT to give you context so then you could start over on Gemini or another model?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Basically tell the chat, hey, can you compress all of this medical information into a kind of summary that's going to be passed on to another doctor, couched with a lot of words to make sure that it like gets things completely and provide like a basically a brief so that it can be moved over. And I think the challenge with that is potentially there's a lot of kind of like raw longitudinal, for example, test results in that chat. And so not all of that would be compressed and moved over. And then if you have a specific question where you're like, oh, this specific test result within the context of all of these test results that are in here, can you interpret that now in a different way than you did before? And it may be that it's like not very good at that anyway. But the broader point is it's not just one chat. It's like a whole series of chats that I have embedded in that particular tool. So porting them all over one at a time does not seem like it's a
But as soon as there's an agent, you can have the agent do it for you. You can say summarize the first half of this, summarize the second, whatever. But let's get into the real meat of the issue here. Nick, why don't you read us some tweets from some credible people out there on Gemini 3
versus OpenAI. We'll leave it up to Brett and Frank to be able to guess who this quote comes from.
Benioff.
Okay. Well, not fun.
Wow.
Prediction
market. You can read the quote, but that's clearly the one that's been said.
Yes.
But yes, go on.
Holy shit. I've used ChatGPT every day for 3 years. Just spent 2 hours on Gemini 3. I'm not going back. The leap is insane. Reasoning, speed, images, video, everything is sharper and faster. It feels like the world changed again. Heart, robot, emoji, end tweet. Is that how
an announced partnership between Google and Salesforce to be announced 2 days from now? Like, I just don't think it's... Frank, okay, you've used them. Was your response to Gemini, holy shit, the world has changed. This is where I'm doing all of my work from now on?
My response was, okay, I'm going to throw this in the mix and use it more. We were discussing last week, you know, the kind of NVIDIA versus Google TPU and what kind of advantages Google has being kind of a full stack AI company where they have the product and AI business, they have the cloud and they make their own chips relative to NVIDIA or OpenAI building on an NVIDIA stack with partners in between. And so I was asking Gemini 3 and ChatGPT with 5.1 thinking about performance per watt comparisons between the latest TPU and NVIDIA's GPUs, because I've actually seen both things stated. Some people are saying, oh, TPU, Google is more performance per watt efficient. NVIDIA is saying, as well as others, that NVIDIA is more performance per watt efficient. The important thing here is, on a CapEx side, Google has a definitive cost advantage. They're not paying NVIDIA's margins to get access to compute. So their CapEx is going to be lower per unit of AI capability. But on operating cost and on revenue generation potential, as I think Jensen Huang correctly states, because there's a power constraint, your revenue is gated based on performance per watt. How many tokens can you generate based on how many watts you have access to in your data center? And there's a split commentary out there. So I asked both models. They both agreed, and they both agreed that NVIDIA has a performance per watt advantage with GB200 versus the TPU V7, which is Google's latest TPU. Maybe that will change in future roadmaps, but the reason I started talking about this is because the Gemini 3 response came back faster and more coherent than the GPT 5.1 thinking. So If you're trying both, you're going to see places where the Gemini 3 model seems better. But it was not transformative in the way that Mark Benioff is saying this. Nano Banana Pro is a different story, though, where I do think that is transformative relative to anything you can get in any other AI product.
I think it's right.
I mean, my very high level, there's two interesting characteristics about the user, at least from what we can see, the user behavior of these models. One is that ChatGPT in the US relative to Gemini is much more dominant than it is globally. And in both geos, it's dominant. So in the US, on an hours used basis at the app level, ChatGPT, and this is prior to the release, so this is as of November 16th, you know, ChatGPT has 99% to 1% share of total hours on the specific app, ChatGPT versus Gemini in the US. In kind of global, it's more like, I think it's 2% share for Gemini. So Gemini overindexes global. But like, forget overtaking ChatGPT. Gemini first has to try to overtake Grok. Grok has four times the number of minutes than Gemini does on its app. So I think that there is like a, call it the leading edge indicator, where it's like Benioff is, one, trying to sign commercial partnerships with these guys. So he has vested interest in saying whatever is going to be the best for his business. But people in Silicon Valley and kind of in SF who are using these models are trying to like read the marginal move. And there is a huge product momentum moat, not moat, I shouldn't say moat, but product momentum advantage that OpenAI has versus these other providers at this point. Ultimately, we think foundation models are going to be worth $15 to $20 trillion in the 2030-ish timeframe, and that there's not going to be one that wins. There's going to be two, three, maybe four. And so is Google a credible and competitive player? Yes. I think that's pretty obvious and evident. I think the Nano Banana Pro, which is a dumb name, is again, that's the more interesting thing that's happening here, because I think it potentially unlocks different use cases that the likes of OpenAI won't be able to provide. And so there's a whole, Nick, you mentioned like basically marketing support and stuff. There's like programmatic or knowledge work categories that were previously offsides that are suddenly onsides, and potentially pushing in that direction from a research perspective actually leads to more profound advances across the stack. Mm-hmm. On a head-to-head basis, I still think it is this category, and what I was talking about last week, network effect or ways in which users will get locked in on this category of goods, certainly than infrastructure as a service and cloud. And that's only, you know, three, and now with NeoClouds, maybe more players with healthy margins. So that's kind of the base case for where this is going
to
go.
All right. We don't need to beat a dead horse here on the back and forth, but I think it's worth noting, if we went back, I'd say 1 year, probably 1 year, 1.5 years, definitely. I don't think Google would have been, of course, they're going to be one of these players, right? Like, there was a clear turnaround. Nick, yes.
Please, give me some credit.
Yeah, Nick definitely was.
That's the staple, but it's like Gemini.
It's like during the Black George Washington and historical figure time period, I think the general consensus was, okay, they're not going to be able to turn this around. They really are vulnerable. But they did. And Nick, there's another company out there that has just sounded the alarm, founder coming back, taking the reins to try and make things happen again. Why don't you tell us about Block's Investor Day?
May I just add one point to the back and forth, please?
Come on. Yeah. Go for it.
Allow me one. I think the mere fact that Gemini is now in Frank's rotation and you're hearing it being, you know, lauded by all of these CEOs, it does begin to bring into question the real moat in AI. And I think it's going to come down to the bundled solution that you can offer. And again, this is completely on the consumer side, so please don't try to bring up enterprise points. In fact, Frank and Brett, we're moving right to Block after I finish this, giving myself the last word. But I do believe that, you know, when you have these, you know, slight changes, and Gemini is now state of the art, and then ChatGPT, I'm sure, will be state of the art in a few months, and then it will keep going back and forth and back and forth. As a consumer, you're going to spend and subscribe to the best bundled offering. And right now, and I've said this from day one, that is the true moat that Google and Gemini will have at the end of the day. Do you know what the killer app or the killer use case for Gemini will be? It's when they take the YouTube premium plan and they throw it into Gemini Pro, not Gemini AI Ultra, which costs $200 a month. When they put it in to the $19.99 subscription, that's when it kills every single amount of pricing power that ChatGPT and other models will try to command. And they need to command it to make their offering profitable. Google doesn't need it. And that's the real power in what Google is going to be able, and Alphabet's going to be able to do in the coming months.
From a consumer perspective, when Blockbuster launched its streaming service, was it at the same price?
These are
as
terrible
Netflix,
analogies.
Or was it lower? No, it
is
lower. just turning a price lever. And actually, if you look, also on
hold the on, hold on, hold on, Nick, I want to hear what. Okay, what was Blockbuster price lower than Netflix?
I'm legitimately curious. I think they did, but I think they tried to bundle it with you sign up for Blockbuster and you get this streaming thing. The incumbent playbook is always, we're going to underprice this competitor and kill them that way. And usually, it's hard. Once you have somebody paying monthly for something, it's kind of hard to shift. I think there's a different question on the indirect monetization front. But also, like last week, when Jim and I showed really no Google search trends gains against ChatGPT of note, you know, in the week of the Gemini 3 release and all of this press and Nano Banana and everything else. So I do think Benioff might be like, oh, it's game over. I think the marginal consumer is not out there being like, now I'm going to adopt Gemini, because they're not paying attention. They have a thing that works, and so then they just keep using it.
That is Google's downfall is... they're just terrible at, it's like they have the best of a lot of things and no one cares. And it's like even going from like their press release to being able to test Gemini took me like three more clicks than it should have. But it'll be interesting to see play out. Nick, let's finally move to Block.
I mean, that it's actually not even worth a response trying to make Google into Blockbuster in this terrible analogy. You're doing our viewers a disservice by even putting that thought in their head. So everyone, please edit it out. No, leave it in. But please don't listen to that. That's not what's happening here. Block. Jack Dorsey, we're back. We're back is kind of the messaging from Block and the management team. We were just out at their investment day in SF. It was very clear, and I think the company itself had been very clear that, you know, over the last 2 years leading up to 2025, so 23 and 24, there was a concerted effort in reorging the company. They had made a very large acquisition in Afterpay, which is a buy now, pay later solution into the market. And I think that bogged down a lot of resources. Plus, there was some internal structuring changes that needed to be made on the product development side. And it was funny because we had actually done the exercise and looked at, you know, how much new product innovation Block had put out. And over the last 2 years, it was really nothing. And I don't feel bad saying that because the company itself would say it. But at 2025 has rolled around, they made some key structural changes at the management level and reorged how product is developed internally at Block. And I think it's beginning to show. And part of this story, not, you know, we can't really get away from it, is around AI. One of the quotes that Jack Dorsey gave at the Investor Day was, internally, the ethos at Block right now is if it can be automated, it must be automated. And you're starting to see that in the rollout of their products. So there's two products they seem very excited about. One is called ManagerBot. The other is called MoneyBot. You can think of this as, on the manager bot side, a CFO for hire or COO for hire, or a digital CFO or digital COO running for a company, a merchant, using a Square POS terminal. And then on the money bot side, this is a model that you can ask about your spending habits, expenses, how can I be better at saving? A lot of different, I think, use cases there on the personal CFO side of the equation. And what's really interesting is to see, how fast these products were developed. I think it's either MoneyBot or ManagerBot was developed in 6 weeks, and the other one was developed in 8 weeks to get to a minimal viable product internally. And so to think about where the company was 2 years ago, where innovation had essentially stalled, to now they're putting out these products at warp speed compared to where they were, I think speaks volumes, one, about the positioning of this company in terms of what's happening in AI and the value it's been able to bring to them specifically, but also just thinking about how far they've come in such a short amount of time. So very excited about what they're doing. We've always been excited thinking about this company specifically when you have on the Square side of the business this merchant terminal. But then when you loop in Cash App, which there were some crazy stats there, I didn't know the Cash App debit card with teens is used by one out of every five teens in the country. So they have this massive distribution base, I think 58 million Cash App users. And now they're trying to intimately tie the two businesses together, which is a great sign of things to come, in our opinion.
All right, Brett and Frank, Jack is back. Is that enough?
Frank.
They're shipping more products and features, which is a significant change than before. So I think it's a marginal change for the good.
So you're excited. You think they can, because it's like they really did, it's like they were on such a tear, the underbanked everything. And then it feels like the competition came trouncing in, not just from direct competition, but from all orthogonal vectors as well. Is it enough?
I'll let Nick answer if it's enough, but I mean,
yeah, I think it's a start, right? You need to be positioned this way, given everything that's happening with AI, right? Every company now is using similar tools. And so if you're not pushing product velocity, someone else is. And their ability to step on and take over some of your turf, so to speak, is, I think increasingly the moats for almost every company have come down a notch or two, because product velocity can be at that pace if you decide to align yourself with the AI tools that are available.
Yeah, I think that there is more importance in innovation velocity than there's ever been. If you don't put gatekeepers in the way, you can ship much more quickly now than you've been able to in the past. And that's what's been characteristic of, back to the core AI guys. OpenAI certainly has, extraordinarily frequent product updates and releases, same with XAI, and also Google too. I mean, there was an article about, talk about Founder coming back, unlocking, basically getting the bureaucracy out of the way of shipping is a really important reason why founder-led orgs can work when kind of orgs run by Tim Cook can no longer work. And I think that that's at the core of why Google accelerated here versus not. And so then Jack coming back and being like, no, we just need to integrate these businesses more completely, take advantage of the new tooling that we have is important at the margin for them.
I think the bots that they announced they instantly make a lot of sense to me. There's so much potential for AI to increase financial literacy and better financial habits, and I haven't seen anybody do that well at scale. There's interesting startups that are doing that, but Block has the perfect customer base to push that into with Cash App, and could do it in a way you can see, maybe you want to apply buy now, pay later to this, and it drives incremental activity in the app and things like that. And then the same on the manager bot side, where there's probably so many different ways that merchants on Square could be more efficient. And if you can proactively help them run their businesses better, that increases all the economics for Block being kind of the platform provider.
Yeah, it was the idea was really, we want to give back time, right? And I think that's a huge story and component of AI is, you know, when you do free up an entrepreneur's time to not have to sit down and be both CEO and CFO, and you can delegate now all of that CFO work to manager bot, right? That, you know, really starts to embed Square's product deeply into an organization more than it ever has before. And I think that that's really the exciting story on both sides is, you know, we're not going to have to do a lot of the things we have to do now, even though we don't like them, because we can pass off all of that to these agents, bots, whatever we're going to end up calling them.
All right. We're going to go on to the next topic here. And acquisitions can mark bottoms, they can mark tops, or they can just happen. How do you like that as a compliant answer? There's a big acquisition in the genomics space. Brett, what was acquired by who? Is it just a run-of-the-mill acquisition, or do you think it is a mark of something changing?
Well, one, I think the genomic space is more M&A sensitive than other spaces because so many of the companies, certainly on the biotech side, the playbook is you're running on cash burn for, you know, early stage biotech. They're constantly burning cash and having to come back to market to raise additional capital to get to a commercialization threshold. And then they're effectively selling off portions of their assets to bigger players along the way to help allay that cash burn. And so that M&A had been totally offsides due to regulatory constraints broadly from, call it, across the entire Biden administration, really hurt small, innovative companies because they could only go to market to raise capital. They couldn't threaten to be sold to somebody else. And so then they had no negotiating leverage against the market. And the marginal market participant is like, yes, we will try to short you to zero. And sometimes they succeeded. So that's kind of like the broad framework here. Exact Sciences is a company that has Cologuard, which is a stool sample you can use to avoid getting a colonoscopy. It's not quite as good as a colonoscopy, but it can happen kind of upstream of a colonoscopy or more frequently. And they just signed a deal with Freenom, which does a blood-based kind of like colon cancer screening test. There's Guardant is a competitor in that area where you, instead of doing even a stool sample, you take blood. You can do it with some frequency, and you can say, hey, you know, you should probably get a colonoscopy now because this indicates there might be something wrong. Abbott Labs, which you may think of as providing COVID tests for at home, has stepped in to buy Exact for some billions of dollars. It's Abbott's biggest acquisition ever. And it looks like the way the market's pricing it, it is going to go through. And I think it is indicative of the fact that people are realizing that this blood-based diagnostic, particularly for cancer and early stage cancer, is going to be a big growing category that's upstream of a lot of stuff. If you're able to detect a cancer for a patient so they know they need to be treated, you can also turn around and go to a drug developer and say, hey, we have this really sensitive indicator for this particular type of cancer. Do you want to try to develop a drug against that in combination with our data? And so it's not just monetizing at the patient level, the data itself is super useful and interesting. And so I think it's kind of legitimizes this entire blood biopsy space as it grows. And in the future, given the data that these companies are collecting, it might not be, you know, a cancer-only kind of diagnostic tool. There are many, many diseases that we really don't understand very well at all, in part because we just diagnose the symptoms. It's like, oh, you have these amorphous set of symptoms. You have an autoimmune disease that we don't totally understand. It could be that there's actually indications in your blood from the molecular signals of those diseases that actually give you an earlier indication that this is happening and then will allow drugs to be developed precisely for these misunderstood diseases, which are probably like lumps of diseases that we're crudely categorizing together. And so in some ways, I think this is the diagnostics business has always been thought of as this quasi-terrible business, very low margin. Anybody can do it. You know, you send your blood off to Quest Diagnostics and they charge like $2 to get like some metabolite out of your blood. Whereas these tests that Exact and Guardant and Natera and Tempus and Caris are doing are multi-$1,000 tests that then avoid or inform, you know, treatments that could be $100,000. And so the value proposition is there. Sometimes you're avoiding doing a chemo run that you would otherwise need to do. And they have a different margin profile and the business prospects are very different and the economic impact could be severe. And so this acquisition, one, like in that space, it's like, oh, this is a real space that's going to grow a lot and it's interesting and really big guys are getting interested in it. And then across the multi-omic space, it's, you know, there's also been some acquisitions in the biotech area. I think the M&A activity actually can flush cash into those businesses in a way that makes them much more constructive and financeable from a public market perspective. And so in this case, I would say, I mean, I hope it marks the real bottom for genomics, which has been a terrible sector to be invested in for about a half decade. And I think that there's like a lot of signs that there's a real, you know, multi-billion and really tens of billions dollar business opportunity in front of these molecular diagnostic companies.
Let's move on to the ledger. All right. For this week, we're going to make it relevant to what Brett indicated. We're going to go CEO exits. And this is, this is an interesting market because there's not one. We have 2025. We've got 2027. Nothing for 2026. So which CEOs will be out before 2027? And I'll give you the, you got Tim Cook at 78%, Brian Armstrong at 50%, Sundar Pichai, 47%, Sam Altman, 43%, Andy Jassy, 41%. So I think it's pretty interesting. This is, you know, a lot of the, it's like, this is a lot
I
of the,
like,
this is,
I when, feel like what, all of those odds are 27. Yeah, those but, are all yeah. way too high.
It's basically a coin flip on every single one.
I know. That's why I thought this was so interesting. So Tim Cook, I think, is the most interesting because if you say, is Tim Cook out in 2025, the odds are 2%. Tim Cook out as Apple CEO by March 31st, 2026, 22%. And then out before 2027 is 78%. So clear.
Is before 2027, year end 26?
Yes, year end. This is ends December 31st, 2026. So this is a very low volume market currently. But I was shocked because these are all very high for some of the biggest tech companies out there. So let's start.
Well, let me put it this way. Apple stock is at an all-time high, and they've been horrible on AI. But they struck a deal with Google to license Gemini for $1 billion. Which Google probably spent tens of billions training. I don't think he's out. Those are wrong. Maybe he should be, but I think the probabilities are wrong.
All right, so agreeing
to pay Google $1 billion for their AI a year should be disqualifying for him. He should be out.
All right, so you're taking the yes?
Severe strategic mismanagement. Well, but that's the 80% chance he's gone by end of 27. I mean, like Frank said, stock is at an all-time high. It's not like the board is going to force him out. It would have to be Tim realizing that, hey, you know, I've ground this thing down into like a really challenging situation here, so I'm going to pass the reins to somebody else to accept the blame when Apple falls apart.
There's a lot of speculation, and I think the reason that one is so high specifically is that one has the most attention from, you know, there are real credible rumors going around about, you know, strategic planning around who will be next. I've seen a lot of reports, you know, over the last few months. So that one feels like it has the most teeth. The other ones are just, quite frankly, shocking. Like 50% odds of Sundar and Brian Armstrong, Coinbase and Alphabet, or Alphabet and Coinbase, that in 2 years, oof, that's doesn't add up to me. So I would take no on those. Apple, I would say yes, just because of the credibility. I forget the last one though, Sam.
All right, I'm gonna tell you. So maybe, so Brian Armstrong, it says it has $0 of volume. So maybe this is just totally. If I go to place the bet. Yeah, it moves very quickly. Okay. So that one is like...
So you could, someone on listening to this could set the market right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
People
yes.
should set the market here. I think this is an interesting market.
Invitation to everybody. Yeah. Let's see where the odds are next week.
Yeah, exactly.
I imagine Tim Cook has the most action, right?
Yeah, but again, his action is $2,419 worth. So let's make this market. Let's.
We've learned a valuable lesson that we need to have a volume.
Okay. So then I'll go to one with much more.
Because this is that.
All right, fine. Much more volume. This was the backup one anyway. I was trying to make it relevant because Brett insinuated that Tim Cook was going to get ousted or leave himself. We haven't done it yet. World Cup winner.
I haven't done any of my research here. I don't know. Who's the odds on favorite?
So we got Spain 16%, England 14%, France 14%, Portugal 10%, Brazil 9%, Argentina 9%, Germany 8%, Norway 6%, Netherlands 5%, and then you got the long tail.
It's like a total coin flip on everybody.
I'll take
Brett. You're the closest to football, Frank.
Sure.
We're gonna give you the second closest because you NFT gambled on them, and then Nick Nine.
I also haven't done my research like Brett, but I'm gonna say England pulls it together this year. Just with no
good luck.
No understanding whatsoever of their actual odds.
Do you know what? I am going to go America first here, and I'm going to buy the U.S. at 2%.
That is, I do think
Pochettino is a legitimate coach. Everybody thinks their team is falling apart, but they've showed some like reasonable promise, and it's like an even enough field that, at the very least, I bet I will look smart as they make it into the knockout rounds, and then they'll do something horrific in the quarterfinals or something. But it'll look wise on an intermediate basis.
I think that is a good, if you didn't need to hold it through the termination, I do think the best bet is taking underdogs here that are going to advance through the group stage and people get excited. Nick, I'm assuming you're going with the favorite.
No, I'm going to tail Brett. As an olive branch after our disagreement around Google, I'm going to tail Brett. I like the USA, but I would like to potentially sell in the future. Like if it's at 2 and they win one game and we bump up, I'll probably then switch to the favorite. I don't know if that's allowed.
Sorry, the rules of the ledger is you have to hold till.
I'm still holding. I'm holding with you, Brett. I'm holding with you.
All right, and then I'll go Spain. I'll take the favorite, the early odds favorite.
They were very good in the Euros. The Lamine Yamal is incredible.
It's true. You get to root for, but I think that's I don't know. I guess young people sometimes do good in the World Cup, but sometimes that's like
too much pressure
for them. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everyone. We've got a good opportunity for people to make a market on some exciting tech CEO gambling. And yes, go test Gemini and Nano Banana and take a look at some other genomics acquisition potentials.
Thank you, everyone. ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed
or implied in such statement. ARC assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARC and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.